So to try to give you an overview of their whole southeastern region here about some of the work that's been going on with the roller crimper work. First, you know, a lot of this has really been driven, this was, in particularly North Carolina, this was driven by the farmers. I do an annual polling every year on what they're most interested in having researched. And the roller crimper 3 or 4 years ago was ranked number one, which really caught me off guard when that came back that year. And what is the concern that they have is why are they interested in this system? First, weed management is always, in our polls, been ranked their number one concern that the growers have. Second, what they're doing right now is very, very intensive. So in our area, we're getting up to 5 rotary hoe passes on a soybean crop and on a corn crop. Then they'll come in with up to 3 between row cultivations. So just a tremendous number of passes across the field that they're having to do for weed control. So they saw this system as being both less management intensive and possibly quite a bit cheaper than what they're currently doing. Second, of course, it would be for us to address the environmental concerns that's going on with all this cultivation. So that's a lot of soil disruption. NRCS has been kind enough to fund us for a couple of years looking at this because they've been very concerned about the growth of organic in our state with regard to soil erosion, compaction, carbon retention. And then from, the growers over the long run could benefit from something as well. We have a lot of soils in our area across the southeast where we can have soil organic matter less than 1%. So a lot of benefits can be had by increasing that. Of course, cover crops are nothing new. There's a very long history of research in cover crops in our area. Much of that was in the past was done through incorporation. Good bit of work with mowing. A very ancient practice, and still see this in North Carolina some. Rye cover crop has been practiced for the last couple of hundred years, and then it would be burnt off in the spring. Chemical application now, we have still more recent, but still going back 20 years probably, looking at chemical desiccants of cover crops. Environmentally, a lot of benefits to that relative to all those practices up above, but of course not applicable to organic growers. And so now we come down to rolling crimping as being an option that we're looking at for organic growers. We're very fortunate in the southeast to have the Alabama ARS lab that has been looking at rolling technology since 1993, a long time now, where they were and they have an ag engineer crowd where they have been looking at all kinds of different types of roller technologies. And you can see some of the ones here that, until we started putting this presentation together, I had not seen some of these here where we have rollers adapted to different beds. So what is something distinctive about the Southeast? One thing is, and as I have worked in other areas and come from other regions, wrap your head around, is how very, very long our growing season is. So our corn harvest is a good example of that. You know, we're generally done with the corn harvest across the Southeast by mid-September. And so our window to get in a very good cover crop before soybeans is really not a problem. And so I have a collaboration, in fact, with these folks in more northern. And that's a real issue that they worry about. But in our area, it's just not an issue. Now, we still can have some issues. If you look at our soybean harvest, we can plant parts of the Southeast, for instance, Mississippi Delta. They'll plant a maturity group 3 soybean. They can have that out in August, too, and have plenty of window to plant a cover crop in and come in with corn behind it. In North Carolina, it's more typical to plant very long maturity group soybeans, though, trying to maximize that harvest. And so by that practice, you can run into, we can be harvesting November. Heck, last year it was wet. I finished harvesting my soybeans January 15th. And so then we can really restrict our ability to get a cover crop into the system. Another key feature of the area is just the tremendous amount of biomass potential that is there. And I highlight potential. So I'm giving you a slide of a very good year here that came out of Dr. Grossman's lab. but if you look at the amount of nitrogen that we're capable of producing with a cover crop, with a legume cover crop, huge potential. But I would like to highlight that it is extremely variable, at least the way cover crops have been currently managed, which in cover crops, we don't get a lot of management attention for them in general. So I think that's one of the things that may have to change when you go to this roller system. We got to think of it more like a cash crop, or because it's really our entire weed control program, and so we're going to have to give it a little tender, loving care. But when we were on the phone organizing this conference across all the collaborators, that we thought 2009, 2010 was a great example of what can go, you know, how much variation you can really have. 2010, we just had historically wet and chilly conditions that really set back a lot of our cover crops. And so, you know, in many cases, we saw a halving of the amount of biomass at the same sites where we had had in 2009. But let me highlight how much potential biomass you can have. And here we cited a site. This was not our highest. We averaged across multiple cultivars of rye where we got 12 megagrams per hectare of rye biomass. And so it's really, the potential is very large. When we were putting that slide together on the phone one day, we all agreed that we got to go back to one of the original articles that got a lot of this working on how much mulch does it take to suppress weeds. And saw Dr. Teasdale over there. Chuck Muller and John Teasdale had this article in 1993. And the way they looked at this, they put out the amount of mulch of both rye and vetch. This is actually the rye slide they had in their paper here, that they commonly were able to grow in their area. And that was the 1x rate right here. And it wasn't until the 2x rate, twice what they thought they could generally achieve in the area, till they got significant weed reduction. And then they had very excellent weed control. I hope I'm characterizing you correctly. So going back to that other slide, though, thinking about that, so the 2x rate here, that was, 8,500 kilograms per hectare. So, again, remember, we were able to grow about 12,000 at times, but I think, you know, we have some data I'll share with you. We're getting up over 8,000, 9,000 is not that difficult for us to attain. Now, having all of that residue out there, now that creates its own set of issues. So, no-till planters, when they invented no-till planters, they weren't talking about this situation. This is kind of like, this is uber no-till out here. other issues that can arise. When you have that much biomass out there, the amount of soil drying that can go on is really tremendous. When we got into this, you know, in my research program, we followed the Rodale, how they'd been doing it in Pennsylvania, where they roll and plant at the same time. And so they actually put the roller on the front of the machine, and then they're planting right behind it. And we have a number of years doing that, and we've had some good success some years. It is also the most surefire way to kill every possible seed that you plant out there. And so we're starting to think, particularly on some soil types. And the other, our other partners on this slide presentation, Alabama, Georgia, they have never done that. They have always rolled, waited till they banked enough soil moisture to get a crop up, and then planted the crop. And probably a lot of wisdom in that. Also, the amount of biomass that we're able to grow, we can have some severe lodging issues if you have too much fertility out there. So we really have to pay attention to not having too much biomass that it actually falls over and creates planting headaches for us. And increasingly, in my program, we're seeing a lodging of the soybean cash crop as a result of too much biomass. Let me show you what that looks like out there. Am I doing it on time? So that's severe lodging in my book. I wish I had the slide to show you. Side by side with that, we have plots where we did it in a clean-tilled system, and they all stood up just beautifully. And we've seen this now at 6 site years where every bean in the field dropped over. Now, it's a weird type of lodging. We're actually able to pick them all up with the combine if we go slowly enough. But it's a pain in the neck to pick up with a combine. And it is related to biomass. Actually, if you think about that that Moeller and Teasdale slide again, we're seeing that I consider on our scale that we rate lodging on, anything 3 and above is unacceptable level of lodging. Notice how that you really start to get a lot of 3 and above, right above 9,000 kilograms per hectare, right? When the weed control gets interesting, that's when our crop seems to want to hit the ground. Another thing to deal with, and it's a good thing we do have the ag engineers, Ted Kornicki at Alabama has worked on these designs for rolling on beds and on ridges across a good bit of, as you get along towards the coast, all the way down through the southeast, you have these very wet soils, and we need to have them up on beds or ridges of some sort to be able to germinate the seeds well. So what's the weed control like? Does it look like? Well, this is one of the slides from one of our plots, and it can be excellent. We've got a slight, slide here, we're covering 6 site years. And after we conducted the experiment, we went back and categorized the sites based on how much rye biomass we had grown. So you can see here, in 2 years, we had grown well over 9,000 kilograms per hectare of rye biomass. We had some medium years with 7,000 to 9,000 and the low less than 7,000. And once you start getting up into this medium to high range, we are getting the same amount of yield out of this organic rye set of plots as we are to a conventional check, which is clean tilled bare ground, sprayed with herbicide, and then enforced to be weed free with a hoe if necessary. So we're getting the same yield out of an organic plot as the weed free. I'll say that again, organic as a weed free, because in the years that I've been doing this, I have never seen anything even close to getting the same yield as we can out of a weed free and organic plot. Now, weed control can be horrible as well. So here we see cotton plants emerging in here in a strip till situation with rye, and you can see the number of weeds coming up already. This is Ted Webster's slide out of Georgia, and look what that creates for us. We really got a nice pigweed as a row crop here. When he sent me that slide, I said, I don't care what else the presentation has, I'm going to figure out a way to get that slide into this presentation. So what's different here? I mean, I'm talking about a rosy situation, and I feel kind of rosy about soybean. What's different here in cotton? Well, several different things. One thing, cotton is a crop, if those of you who are not familiar with the Southeast, that is a crop that looks like it wants to die for the first month. It is a very, very slow to emerge crop. And so we have a long time window for weeds to get established out there. Second, if you look at our coastal plain soils, most of them need to be ripped, and so just letting it be no-till from the fall before and through the spring is not going to work. We have too high bulk density there, so we're going to need to loosen that soil a little bit. And so he put a shank down in there and put the trash clears to be able to get the shank in there, and he opened up that slot we showed right there, which was the killer. Third, cotton is generally grown on 36 inches, so you're getting out there pretty wide, and so it has to hang out for a long time. So I think another take-home message I don't have it there is that it's not necessarily this is going to work for all crops. Soybean is looking good. Cotton, not looking so good. Corn, I think the jury is still out, at least in our area. We've just started in the last couple of years looking at this system for corn. And there are some issues. For the first one here is that our growers are generally planting their corn in mid to late April. They like to do that because they're trying to time when historically when our rains occur and when our drought occurs relative to pollination, better said. We haven't found a combination where that will work yet in this system. So we're only getting this to fly when we plant early to mid-May. And you look at this slide, I think this is again out of Dr. Grossman's lab, looking at the effect of different planting dates in amongst different legume crops. And so they're going to have to plant significantly later, and perhaps later than they're comfortable with, to make it fly in corn. And here's been an interesting result out of some of her work, is that some of the previous cover crop research, I mentioned too that we have a lot of work with using chemical desiccants to kill out different cover crops. And there was nothing in that body of literature to indicate that we would see what we've seen over the last couple of years with crimson clover versus hairy vetch mulch. Crimson clover mulch has continued to show a very poor nitrogen release to our cash crop. And so the hairy vetches and mixtures with hairy vetches have worked out a lot better. Right on ahead there. Actually, this is your slide again, Julie, where she documented that the crimson clover plots with a rolled mulch actually had less nitrogen available to the crop for, 12 weeks after rolling, less than available than in a bare ground plot, conventionally tilled, with no nitrogen applied. Last time that plot would have seen nitrogen was the year before. So it's this system, it does change things in some surprising ways at times. And I'm doing well on time here. I think I'll end on here. You know, this is one of those technologies, I mean, heaven knows that academics, we can get out there and start monkeying around with things that may not actually translate or scale up to the real world. But, you know, this one really does seem encouraging to me, and we have growers that have tried this on significant scales, and the logistics of it look good. A lot of those extra steps that are adoption that we cannot think about until the last minute. Look good on this system. Here's a farmer in Virginia who did quite a large field with organic soybeans. And it's been, you know, in North Carolina, we have a guy now who's has gotten a roller. He's got it 25 foot wide, which is another part. This has to scale. When they started out here, when, you know, everybody was testing 8-10 foot rollers, which is what I'm testing, that's all fine and good, but we're not going to be planting, you know, several hundred acres of crops out there with a 10-foot roller. This does scale. The guy that that's in North Carolina, he worked with I&J, who made the rollers for Rodale, and he put 14 foot up the front, out the front, and he put two side rollers out the side and got up to 25 foot. He put the he did go ahead and plant in one pass and put the planter out the back, and he planted 1,500 acres that way. So this is a technology that will scale. All right, I think I've left some time for questions here. All right.
All right. Thank you very much. If there's any questions.
Question about that roller you had pictures of that's designed for beds.
Yes.
Is that either commercially available or have the plans been published?
You know, Ted Kornacki is the one who designed that and has the, holds the patent on that out of ARS Alabama. And I just should call him. I don't know what the status of release on that is. All I know is he's traveled around with that and tested that at a number of locations. But in terms of whether farmers have gotten have built anything yet or how that works, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm just thinking it might be adaptable to raised bed vegetables.
Yes, yeah. And he has a lot of it, and we couldn't embed all of that in here, but,
right.
You know, he's learned a lot about how you have to form the beds and how you do everything. I mean, there's other details that aren't covered here that have to be done for that to work. But we're very keenly interested in it as well. I have several thousand acres of organic grains down in a very wet zone, and so I've got to, we've got to get that to work for us as well.
I don't have a question, but my name is Rupin Award. I'm a member of the Minorities Committee, which is actually now a Diversity Committee under the Tri-Societies.
Yes.
We have invited several 50 high school students from Eagle Rock High School, and we would like you to at least give encouraging words to them so they can get into science. We would like them to join the Tri-Societies in the future.
Oh, great. Well, welcome.
Thank you very much. We have to move on and take them to the
other. Oh, great.
Thanks.
I've got a question about the crimson clover nitrogen release.
Yes.
If you look at the total amount of nitrogen released by the crimson clover, does it add up to what is in the standing biomass? And I guess my question is, in that 2 weeks between rolling and measuring, at the first measurement, you could lose quite a bit of that nitrogen, and it could be that you just lose it all really fast before the corn.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting, though, if you look at it, if I was going to generate an expectation on where I might lose it, I would expect to lose more out of the vetch than the crimson clover. But when I'm actually, based on carbon to nitrogen ratio, based on lignin content.
Right.
But in fact, it's the crimson clover I have the issue, not the vetch.
Right.
So it makes me think it's not a loss. But, you know, really witty soil questions should go to Julie and not me.
The reason I asked is we were monitoring soil respiration after tilling in crimson clover.
Yeah.
And crimson clover, I mean, the respiration is just through the roof compared to the vetch. So it looked like it was losing a lot of that nitrogen.
Well, you know, the protocol that they employed here, correct me if I'm wrong. So, you know, they would have soil samples taken at the time we roll, very low, of course, in any of these, and then the probes are put out right then. So they're put out at the date of roll. So it should capture that. Yeah.
Okay. Last question.
Yeah, just to respond to that, we've seen the same thing in the past, where you get that early yellowing of the corn and crimson clover, but by the time you get to silking, actually, they look about the same as that. So I think that nitrogen does eventually get released.
All right, thank you very much.